Excision number 12519, reel 1.
Air Vice Marshal McGill, Reel 1. Could we start, please, by your telling me where you were born?
Yes, I was born in New Zealand, in a little place called Cambridge.
Which part of New Zealand is
in
that?
In the North Island, about 90 miles south of Auckland, in the middle of the dairying area.
What did your father do for a living?
He was a... you'd call him a general draper, I should think, at that stage.
Were you educated at Cambridge?
No, Arthur? We moved from Cambridge to another place called Tiaraha, where I went through my normal education and to a matriculation standard. Then decided I wanted to be an electrical engineer, and for reasons that don't matter at the moment, I declined to go to university, which of course was a basic error. So I went to a technical college in Hamilton and did a post-matric course there.
How did you come to be in the Air Force?
First and foremost, I decided not to proceed as an electrical engineer. This, if you'll realise, was the immediately after the depth of the Depression. And qualified engineers were being turned out by the various organisations, including university, and there was no opportunities for them. They were getting switchboard operator jobs. So I did one or two other things. I worked for a newspaper for a little while, but I'd always been interested in flying, in aeroplanes anyway. So I decided that it'd be a good idea to try and get into aviation. And it was suggested to me that I should try for a short service commission in the Royal Air Force, not the RNZAF, which I did. And in due course of time, I arrived in England. The system was a strange one, and insofar that, first of all, one had to have a private flying license, the minimum experience, an A license. Then you got a sort of a qualified recommendation through the Royal New Zealand Air Force, which you took in your own funny little hand to England, but it gave you no guarantee whatsoever of acceptance in the Royal Air Force. So on arrival in England, one went through the normal processes, and what one applied for was a short service commission of 4 years on the active list and 6 on the reserve. The theme, my object then in that being that I would get really first-class flying instruction and experience, and at the end of the 4 years on the active list, I would return to New Zealand and enter, hopefully, into the embryonic civil aviation world out there. A little bit of simple arithmetic will tell you that at the expiry of my 4 years active list, I was not released from the Royal Air Force. I was in the middle of Africa having a go at the Italians in Eritrea.
What was your reaction when you heard that we were at war with Germany?
Well, it was quite normal, I think. You see, I joined the Royal Air Force in 1936, so one was a professional. And having joined a military organisation, it just shouldn't come as a great shock to you if you were required to fulfil your undertakings. So I was actually in the Sudan, in the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan, during the Munich crisis, and that made us all think of it. And we were there, of course, when war was declared against Germany. But we were not directly involved until the Italians came in the June of 1940.
You were with 47 Squadron.
47 Squadron.
Can you tell me about that?
Yes, it was remarkable in those days because I think one saw the last of the effect of British Raj element, I should, is the best way to put it, of the Brits administering the Sudan. As you may recall, it was known as the Anglo-Egyptian Sudan. There was an Egyptian presence there, but there's no shadow of doubt whatsoever as to who administered the country, and they did it extremely well. There's a very select and relatively small body of men that controlled the Sudan itself, which, as you know, is greater than the size of of Europe, and they handled it extremely well. And I think they left quite a lot behind them, which is still to the advantage of the Sudan. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. There we were, a single squadron on a station, 1,000 miles south of Cairo, and with this tremendous parish to look after. You grow up fast in those for circumstances.
What kind of a squadron was 47?
It was it was you'd call it a light bomber squadron in those days. It was a four-flight squadron equipped with obsolescent aeroplanes. It had one rather unusual characteristic that one of the flights on an ancient form of aeroplane known as a Fairy Gordon spent half the year on floats, and we used to potter up and down the Nile for 6 months of the year as float planes rather than land planes. It was very interesting indeed.
Fairy Gardens?
Yes. Yeah.
What were they like?
Slow, safe, fairly reliable, very slow and very old. In those days, there were, I think it was 127 landing grounds of sorts scattered throughout the Sudan, and one tried to visit them once every 2 or 3 years. And there were what they called floatplane reaches as well, which were areas on the banks of the Nile where you'd, opposite the banks of the Nile, obviously, where you would land and tie your aeroplanes up to the bank overnight and stay with the either the Sudan Defence Force or the local administrators, the assistant district commissioners and sort of people, who were really first-class citizens. I think I'm right in saying that at that stage, apart from academic qualifications, one had to be at least a half-blue to get into the Sudan civil service. So they weren't all brains, there was a fair bit of brawn with them as well. There was one chap, I think, who was a relic of World War I, and he was known as Captain Arthur Forbes, and he stayed on or was taken, accepted into the Sudan civil service. And but all the others were graduates, mainly Oxbridge.
What was the base of the 47 squadron
Khartoum.
In the Sudan?
Khartoum
itself.
Khartoum, yeah. Mm.
And the personnel of the squadron at that time?
Oh, I can't. I was just a pilot officer when I started, but I shouldn't think we were more than about 300 all told, I suppose. And the squadron commander was the station commander. He did the whole thing. I think we had a complement of about 24, 25 officers all told.
Were they experienced?
Some were, yes. Others were short service commissioned people like myself. The squadron commander obviously was an experienced man. And there was one other airman down there. He was attached to the head of the Sudan Defence Force, and he was a sort of staff officer. And he was a wing commander. The other chap was a squadron leader. So that was the relative ranks, and rightly so, I think, in those days, where these chaps had tremendous responsibilities and carried them out very well.
So was the main function of the squadron at that time to keep an eye on the Italians?
Not so much No. We were available, I think, to... I think the... I now actually remember seeing the policy for the squadron. We were available to cooperate with the Sudan Defence Force and the civil power, if necessary, and to keep open these facilities in the various parts of the country. Not forgetting, of course, that it wasn't all that long after the 1935-36 Abyssinian affair, so there were on the Red Sea and down, on the Abyssinian side, there were still relics of the reinforcement that had taken place there. But obviously our war role was to do what was required to in support of the army and air force wise against the Italians. Not that we, at that stage we had much capability, but for instance we were bombed up during the Munich crisis purely as a precaution, and we had World War One weaponry strapped to our ancient airplanes.
What did that consist of?
112-pound World War One bombs. Would have been very interesting to see taking place. And we had our targets, but naturally nothing happened.
Did you ever operate in the Sudan in defence of the civil power?
No, I didn't, but personally, but one or two people did. Although my memory is very vague about that, but I remember a small detachment being sent down to the, let me get this right, it'd be the southeastern border with it would be Abyssinia, where there were from time to time, as indeed is the case in Kenya, there were tribal troubles or border troubles. That, as you know, we made a lot of mistakes in Africa over drawing geographical lines across the territories of nomadic tribal interests and so forth and so on. And I think at one stage there was a bit of raiding going on, and the district commissioner down there asked for a bit of help, and the Sudan Defence Force did. And one of my flights sent two or three airplanes down, but I don't think they were called upon to do anything drastic. But the capability was there, and we knew the country pretty well.
The Italians came into the war in the summer of 1940.
In June, yes.
What happened to you then?
I've got an actual date. It's in June. I should remember it very well. We'd changed to a less obsolescent type of aeroplane then, called the Vickers Wellesley. It was been phased out in England, but we were ready to go by then. And on the evening before it was expected that the Italians would come in, we were bombed up and briefed. By that time, another squadron had come down to the Sudan from Amman in Jordan, and another squadron had come up from Kenya. So we were a wing of three squadrons, and then we were deployed to war stations in further out in the desert. And we were briefed and ready to go, and we went to bed, and about just before midnight I was woken up to say the whole thing was off. Well, a certain amount of relief then, I think, but about an hour later I was woken up again to say it was on. And off we went, and took off about 4 a.m. in the darkness, and we were at war. Simple as that.
Can you describe your first operation as you remember it?
I remember very well, yes. Like everything else, it's a matter of blasting off into the unknown, I think. And we, our 47 squadron's task was to attack the airfield at Asmara. 14 squadron was at Port Sudan, and they went for Massawa. And 2-3 squadron, the ex-Rhodesian squadron, went to a fighter base a bit further south at Gura. And we took off in our usual way and form up, and off we went. And they found the target, all right. No difficulty.
What was the target?
Asmara, the capital of Eritrea.
What in Asmara, though?
The airfield itself. And they, well, the Italians were there in strength because they'd been reinforcing Eritrea through Khartoum. And we saw a lot of these chaps on their way through before they came into the war, and we met one or two of them, and we agreed we might meet again in other circumstances. It was a fairly successful day, I think. We didn't run into much opposition, a little bit, and came back, and that was the beginning, and we carried on.
Did any Italian aircraft come up?
Yes, they didn't get very close to us on that occasion. I think we caught them unawares, trousers down, or whatever it was like.
Could you see the fall of your bombs?
Yes, indeed. We went in fairly low level, so there was no problem with that. So it didn't do too badly. It disrupted the airfield a bit, and one or two in the hangars.
Did you go for the hangars? Or
well, both, yes. The tarmac and the hangars. The one, we did a formation 1,500 foot fly through the tank.
Why were these Wellesleys better than the Gordons?
Well, they were considerably faster, and the Gordons, we also had Vincents before, I should have mentioned that, but they were very slow by modern standards. They would do a good one to do about 150 miles an hour. They go a long way, though, a very long way.
What would a bad one do?
anything you like. No, that's average sort of cruising speed.
How did the operations develop after that?
We carried on doing a formation, daylight operation, sometimes in cooperation with another squadron. Usually we cooperated with the 14 squadron now and again. But usually we'd send off about five at a time, and for selected targets, airfields and things like that. And later on, we were cooperating with certainly with the army, of course, as they started to advance into Eritrea, and with those operating behind the lines. For instance, there was a fellow called Wingate down there at the time, and we flew him in. They got, I didn't, but... I'd taken over the squadron by then, but we're digressing a bit. But there were still some of the old Vincents lying around, and in fact there was a flight of them. But one of my pilots was briefed to take this chap in, and the irregulars under command of some British officers behind the lines prepared a strip, a very short strip in a suitable place. And Wingate came down. He stayed the night with us before he went, and we loaded him in, and they took him and landed in the strip. The Italians obviously knew something was going on, but they didn't find this airplane, although it stayed there for several days. And they left Wingate in there, and then they brought the airplane back. And while they were in there waiting to be told what to do, some of the Abyssinians took the pilot and the navigator up to what they considered to be part of the headwaters of the Nile and baptized them under Amharic and what are they, dear my memory, of course, as you know, Haile Selassie was considered to be the Lion of Judah, and they were, well, I suppose they're Copts, really, aren't they?
Yes. So.
These chaps came back. Incidentally, the pilot of that aeroplane is in this country, and he might be of interest to you.
Yes, he would.
Yeah.
What impression did Wingate make on you personally?
I don't want to be commit libel or thing, but I thought he was a very strange man. I was living in the residence of the Assistant District Commissioner, this was in Sana'a, one of the dams just up the Blue Nile from Khartoum, where we were based at that time. And he kindly put Wingate up for the night before. And we talked well into the night. He, of course, was very pro-Zionism, very anti-Egyptian. And he had rather two interesting ideas about what might be done to assist.
Such as?
Well, he thought it would be a bad idea to blow up the low dam at Aswan and wash most Egyptians into the sea. I think we'd better expunge that.
In what way did he come across as strange, apart from this idea?
Well, he was an irregular soldier, and that's in the proper sense of the word. We did some funny things for him, but I think they did quite well. But we dropped Maria Theresa dollars and that sort of thing in the middle of the night. The irregulars would light a few smudge fires, and we'd put these rather good-looking silver dollars. We could have done with a few of them, as you can imagine. And the technique is very simple. We just did them as a dead drop. They were in bags, and we put them in another bag inside another bag. And it worked very well. The inside bag burst, obviously, but with a sequence of bags, we'd eventually keep them together. One wonders how many of these bags we dropped were found. We were told that the drops were successful, but I got a sneaking feeling that somewhere or other in some jungle areas of Eritrea or Ethiopia, one or two bags of some Mariah Theresa dollars lying about.
Was it easy to find these?
Yes, because normally we did that in very good weather. And we had no navigation aids, but we knew the territory pretty well. And it was usually done on a triangle of fires. You had to be a bit careful about that, because the natives would have odd fires burning around their tuckles and that sort of thing. The Italians, of course, had fighters before we did. So after a while, we were really forced out of the day sky and did stuff at night, except until later on, when the South African sent up a squadron of fighters, first gladiators and then hurricanes, and they covered us when it was necessary. And of course we were directly concerned with some of the very bitter battles, like the Battle of Keren, and when the army were in the north going through towards Asmara itself. And we did a lot with direct close support, with daylight bombing, that sort of thing.
Did the squadron have many casualties in the
fight? I can't remember, I can't give you a figure, but we lost quite a few. Some to fighters, some to one or two to anti-aircraft fire. But after Asmara was declared an open city, I took an aeroplane in there and went in, and I actually found one or two of our crew who had been prisoners of war. And my memory's bad. I can't tell you how many. Our casualties weren't inordinately high, but there was one thing to remember, that if you were shot down or if you fell down, the territory was pretty inhospitable. And of course the locals, the people, probably if they knew a war was on, they probably didn't know much about it. Or if they did know much about it, they'd probably been fairly roughly handled by the opposition when too good. And they were fairly warlike people themselves anyway. So we used to carry a bloodshed with us, but I don't recall hearing of anybody who was taken by the natives, who were actually seriously mishandled. But the elements were far from hospitable, let's face it. All right, from a flying point of view, but if you're forced, if you're forced down, you'll have a problem.
Were there any climatic problems to cope with?
Heat. If you were forced down, it's a lack of water would be a problem.
But from the flying point of view?
No, just severe turbulence times because of the heat. When we were attacking Eritrea, at a certain season of the year, we ran into a lot of thunderstorms and things like that. They would come home. They were just too rough. There was no point. Because the mountains went up to about 15,000, 17,000 feet.
What did you think of the Italian opposition to you?
Not a lot. Their fighters were not as aggressive as ours, thank goodness. But like most things Italian, when you get into that sort of, like the motor racing world, that sort of thing, they're inclined to produce one or two very good ones. But as an example, there was one chap, he led, as far as we understood it, led a fighter squadron, but when he was leading these fighters, you could expect really close combat and serious trouble. We knew him as Pedro. And sadly, we heard later on that he survived the war, but he actually got shot in the back by one of his own chaps who was taking rather a long pot shot at a British aeroplane while Pedro was closing in on the more aggressive and approved form of attack. But he survived. But in the main, they were not, I didn't think, as good as our people were. We didn't see much of their bombers, enough, but not too much. I don't know. It's very difficult to say, but that was the general impression one got anyway, that they weren't as of the same standards as we were. Now, that sounds terribly self-opinionated, I suppose, but I think we had the right to have the edge on them. They had some good equipment.
Are there any other incidents that you can recount in this air struggle in Abyssinia?
No, I think I was impressed with the efforts of the British, in a very broad sense, army at the Battle of Keren, for instance. They had to attack the Italians on their own ground in appalling conditions, really, because the terrain was really precipitous, if you like. Range to an inch by the opposition was almost like taking the British Army on in a Salisbury plain. And the Scots, the British, and the Indians were all there, and I had nothing but admiration for them. They're tremendous.
Did you give them close support?
Indeed, yes, all the time.
What did the close support consist of?
Well, selected targets, but at one stage we kept an aeroplane over the top of the area virtually all day and just loosed a bomb off now and again to try and keep the Italian heads down. But otherwise there were selected targets. The